You got to go from proto banking to full service banking, and then to central banking and, interconnected central banks. And a lot of that is actually a technological story. And I don't think it gets covered enough because most people covering it, historians and economists, aren't necessarily looking at it through the lens of technology. And at most, they'll give a caveat like, oh, the telegraph allowed this. But it's like, no, that's actually, that's not like a footnote. That's a core thing that happened that changed everything. And so that's why I wanted to focus Broken Money on not just individual decisions, but actually how technology dictates the changing money over time.
Lynn, welcome to Bitcoin Audible.
Thanks for having me.
For sure. It's been long overdue. I don't even know how many pieces of yours I've read on the show. There's actually a hand, like just like four or five authors that I was thinking about, like within the last month, I was like, oh my God, I haven't had Lynn on the show. I haven't had Nick Bhatia, I don't think, on the show, or at least if I had, it's been like 500 episodes ago. There was like a whole group, and I was just like, well, shit, what the hell? And so I hit you up. I was like, we have got to do a show together, especially just after Broken Money. Thank you for making the time, especially since I have apparently screwed up what hour it was we were supposed to do this. I
no,
appreciate
it's all
it.
Good. It's all good. And thank you for narrating the book Broken Money. For people that are listening that don't know,
oh,
Guy
yeah?
Narrated Broken Money, so the Audible version. And so I think that it's actually, I was surprised at how many people wanted the audio version. I wasn't sure if it's, it's a long book. There's a decent number of charts in it. Of course, it comes with a chart book, but I wasn't sure what the demand would be. And of course, one of the most common questions early on was when Audible? and it's doing well. So I'm glad that there's a lot of demand for, your audio version of it.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Me too. It's funny too, because, I used to read furiously. I mean, I still do, obviously, but I genuinely only actually sit down and read the things that I'm recording now, which is still a ton. But if honestly, I go to straight to audio. I go straight to Audible if I'm trying to consume something, because it's unbelievably convenient. And I think with kind of the podcast era, like everybody's listening to something, so it's easy to just, put it in the routine, so to speak.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Well, speaking of the book, actually, before we get into the book, you do actually lay this out a little bit in at the beginning, but I don't think a lot of people know about your background. And that's kind of something that I always thought was really interesting, is how your background informs your analysis of kind of what's going on and how you see the relationships and kind of the macro environments and the technical realities of kind of networks and systems as opposed to politics and culture, so to speak. Expand on that a little bit for me.
Yes, my professional background, even though what I do now is focused full-time on finance, I originally did engineering. So it was electrical engineering. And then shifted over time more towards kind of engineering finance and engineering management, in the sense that I, worked several years as actual electrical engineer. We were building like aircraft simulators and operating aircraft simulators, and I would build the electrical systems, control systems for them. And then I shifted to partially kind of like running all the procurement for the engineering facility, so managing our budget and then kind of buying all these things, trying to find all the way to source things, so that financial blend. My master's was in engineering management, because I kind of realized, you kind of realize early on whether or not you're like a hardcore engineer or not, like a really, really good engineer, when they're done it, when they go home, they go home and they're still engineering. They're like tinkering in their garage.
Yeah, yeah.
and I really wasn't that type of engineer. I kind of realized it in college, actually. Like I'd get there and like they're like, hey, like I already build circuits. I'm like, you already build circuits? Like I came here to learn how to build circuits. What do you mean you already build? So you kind of realize that like there's certain people that are just that's their passion. And you're, whereas mine was that broader view of kind of bringing things together. So the technical perspective, mm-hmm. but then also managing people, managing money, and trying to do that stack of things. And so I shifted more towards engineering management. And I eventually was basically the head engineer for that facility where, you know, upper management has their goals. The individual engineers all know their areas of expertise. And I was the one in the middle trying to, you know, get funding, figure out how to allocate funding. You know, when there's, you know, you get all your senior engineers together and it's like, okay, how are we going to build this system? Well, how are we going to solve this problem? And kind of give the green light. Okay, this is the design we're going with based on all the information we have available. So you had to understand a little bit of everything, but of course rely on people that were subject matter experts in their area. But on the side, I mean, I hadn't been investing since I was a kid. I grew up kind of in poverty. And so I started collecting, you know, gold, silver coins, started saving cash dollars, and eventually started getting into equity investing. And so even in college, I had like a little equity blog that I was kind of like write about companies I'm interested in and write a little bit about personal finance. And I eventually sold that to a larger publisher. Yeah, it's just, you know, it was like a little hobby. So I was like basically, even though I was engineering, I was investing on the side and even writing about it because my writing skill was not good. But just doing it 1,000 times basically made it halfway decent. So now people like the writing. And I'm like, you should see what my English teacher said back in the day. Cause they certainly didn't like my writing. But it just go through enough reps. And so for me, it's that blend of that engineering and the financials that I find interesting. And the way that I kind of bridge them together is that, I studied system engineering. Basically, how do you design or operate a system that's more complex than any one person knows? There's no one person who knows how an entire airplane works from, you know, every little like semiconductor in the avionics to the aviation, like the aerospace of the whole thing, all the material science, everything, right? It's something that's bigger than any one part. And that's true even for an aircraft simulator. You know, like I did the electrical thing. We purchased avionics. We know roughly how they work, but you know, we're not experts on the inside of avionics. The mechanical engineer knows a lot. And over time, I learned a lot about the mechanical side, but never as much as he knows. The software people know all that part. I have to learn some of that. And they have to learn some of the electrical. So everyone kind of knows a big chunk of how a simulator works, but nobody actually knows how the entire simulator works. And that's true for any sort of complex engineering system. So when Apple makes an iPhone, there's nobody at Apple that knows every detail about that iPhone. And so systems engineering is the art and science of managing, like building and managing a system that is more complex than any one human mind knows. And that is actually pretty applicable to global finance, that basically the mixture of banks and central banks and capital markets is basically a big system. And in fact, it's really a control system. There's inputs and outputs and governing logic and, you know, occasional changes to the governing logic. And so kind of that insight was you can analyze it like a control system. And of course, there's political elements that go into it and there's other things like that. And then you also take a step back and realize that even the way the system's set up is not just system engineering, but then it's actually based on technology. So for example, the telegraph gives us a very different global finance structure than pre-telegraph. And the internet gives us a different global financial structure than pre-internet. And so as we kind of moved up the scale of technology, that affects what we use as money and then how we interact with the money that we do use. And that could be as basic as things like the invention of paper, the invention of book binding rather than scrolls, the inventing of inks and the printing press, the usage of analog encryption. So if you make a bill of exchange, how do you make it really hard to forge? You know, you don't want to owe, you don't want, if you do certificates that show you owe something, you don't want people being able to copy those. So you end up owing more than you actually really owe. You don't want people redeeming things that they shouldn't have. And so even things like analog encryption, analog forgery resistant things is the type of technology. And so those all led to the development of banking over time. And you got to go from proto banking to full service banking. And then to central banking and, you know, interconnected central banks. And that a lot of that is actually a technological story. And I don't think it gets covered enough because most people covering it historians and economists aren't necessarily looking at through the lens of technology. And at most, they'll give a caveat like, oh, the telegraph allowed this. But it's like, no, that's actually, that's not like a footnote. That's like, that's a core thing that happened that changed everything. And so that's why I wanted to focus Broken Money on not just individual decisions, but actually how technology dictates the changing money over time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely, I think, the heart of the book that I think is kind of novel in the way that it's framed. Because, I mean, I completely agree. I've largely, I came at the entire economic and monetary space from a sort of moral perspective. And that's something you explicitly talk about in the book too, is that, you know, most people have kind of a cultural moral judgment over how the system works, and they see, you know, some supposed moral failure because of a means of abuse or manipulation within it, when the reason that is even exposed is easier to define, is more concrete when you think about it in a technological perspective, not a, oh, there's just bad people doing this perspective. I want to get into that in just a second, but one of the things I really wanted to hit first, because I had an Austrian economics background coming from this, and I think one of the most fascinating things that you do at the very beginning of the book, and then you do such a good job of laying it out in every single chapter, of refreshing, just like kind of pinging that idea again, is about who controls the ledger, and that you bring together the credit theory of money and the commodity theory of money in a way that I was never really able to articulate. Like, I always tried to explain it in the idea of, like, if you just put all the gold in the vault and then you just locked it down, it all just destroyed, or an alien came down and it just vanished, but you still had like these notes, would it still work? You know, like, I was trying to explain that connection, but I think you did such a good job. So for anybody who hasn't read the book, how did you bridge the credit theory of the Keynesians and the commodity theory of kind of the Austrian school into one theory, so to speak?
So a couple main ways kind of came together. One is recognizing that both of those schools of thought of what money is are basically the two ways to solve the double coincidence of wants problem. So, you know, if we're in a primitive environment, we're trying to trade, we have the challenge that I have to have a surplus of something that you're deficient in, and you have to have a surplus in something that I'm deficient in order to trade on the spot. And the two main ways to avoid that kind of narrow trade problem is either deferment through time, a type of credit. Basically, like, if we know each other and I have a surplus in something that you need and I don't really need anything right now, I can give you part of that surplus, meet your need. And then later, because I recognize there's a high probability that sometime in the future I'll have a deficiency and you might have a surplus at that time. And so it can either be an informal gift credit, or it can be more formalized actual, like, okay, here's this, but you owe me this later. So deferring transaction, one side of a transaction in time, increases the rate of success for trading. And so credit is just, it's a foundational aspect of commerce in many ways. The other way, of course, is to have one side of every transaction, or one side of most transactions, be some sort of universal good that has attributes that we consider money-like. So it's liquid, it's fungible, it's recombinable, divisible. It lasts a long time, so we're not, like, you know, holding meat as money. It's, you know, it's metal. It's, you know, something that, or shell beads or something, things that can actually last for years and decades or more. And that makes it so that, you know, you never have to find specific, you know, surpluses and deficits. It's always just money. It's like, okay, here's this thing. If you have money, we can make this transaction. So the combination of deferring things through time and then finding that universal, you know, unit of account or two, it's often two in many cultures. Often you have like a bigger one, a smaller one. You know, it could be copper and cocoa, or it could be gold and silver. Usually there's not one that's sufficient for everything, but it's usually, you know, one, two, or three of them. They're kind of these universal. And where to kind of bring them together was, okay, so they both are the two ways to solve that friction of trade problem. There is a number of writers or discussers that I think brought this up. So I was exposed through it a couple ways. One is John Pfeffer. He mentioned that basically he actually referred to Vincent Casares, who basically said money is a ledger. And so if this works, it's the best ledger, for referring to Bitcoin. And also Gigi wrote some articles about how like money is basically either a token or a ledger. And while I was reading that, I was kind of like, well, a token is in some sense a type of ledger. It's basically, it's just a ledger that not everybody's, like, there's a certain number of tokens in a environment, right? So it could be, let's say they're gold coins or they're shells or something. Even if any one person doesn't know exactly how many gold coins or shells there is actually a number out there in that region for how many of these things exist. And it's updated through physical possession. Yeah. So nature is still running this ledger, even if we only see parts of it, like the fog of war. And so we're still kind of using a physical ledger. It's just, it's not written down and fully known by one person. And then it's actually later that I came across the earlier proponent of this whole concept, which is Ventus Casares. But I originally got that secondhand, because he emphasized 8 or 9 years ago that money is basically a ledger. And, you know, I think there's a couple areas where I would phrase it differently than he did. But he gets a ton of credit for laying that out. And actually I didn't learn it directly from him. I had to go back and, you know, if you Google money is a ledger or something like that, you find a complete dearth of literature on that. Whereas, you know, all of his was encapsulated in like YouTube videos, for example, which are not really, don't search well unless you're on YouTube searching for them. And so it was basically just that idea of trying to broaden the view of money, because I often feel like in economic or specifically monetary literature, people are often talking past each other. So in a lot of Austrian economics books or Bitcoin books, it's really heavily focused on the commodity theory of money, which I think is valuable, but I think that credit still deserves more analysis or more kind of incorporation into that theory. And then also you see in mainstream economic literature, they completely discard the commodity theory of money, and it's all about credit money, which I think is an equal, if not larger, error to make. And so it's, and a lot of times, you know, if you're trying to bridge that gap, you know, like David Graeber's work was very impactful, especially for like the economic left, which is where it kind of led them to kind of disregard barter, disregard commodity money. And so if you're talking to that group, which is a pretty big group, and you just start with, you know, okay, here's a problem of barter and they use commodity money, you're going to lose them right away. Cause they're like, no, I read this chapter. It's called The Myth of Barter. And like, there's errors with it, but there are still some points in there that are relevant from an anthropological point of view. And so I think it's good to steel man that, address it, and incorporate it into a broader theory, which is to say, yes, credit is a part of what money is in some sense. And what they have in common is that these are all just different ways of measuring a ledger, right? So it's either letting nature run most of the parameters of the ledger, or we're letting humans run most of the parameters of a ledger. But either way, it's basically we have this ledger, it's got units, and we're moving those units around. And it becomes questions like who can allow or disallow certain transactions to occur on that ledger? Or who can dictate whether or not more units are added to the system or not, and if so, at what rate? And of course, you get very different answers when you're looking at a natural system that we selected because it's the best properties for money versus one being imposed on us by a local authority or a national authority. But ultimately, that's how I kind of reconcile those ideas.
Yeah, and there's one. Specifically, I like how you really attack the credit theory of money, and specifically David Graeber's book is just a great one for that, to kind of own that framing, because it is true. And one of the things that he specifically lays out in that, and I think you kind of summarized or brought it up in your book as well, was that we don't, you know, when you use the commodity theory of money to explain it, and this is something that Bitcoiners do all the time, is you kind of start from the framing of like, if you don't have a commodity money, you have to barter. But then you go back through history and you actually look, and barter was almost non-existent. Like, it's so inefficient that it literally just never happened. So conceptually, it makes sense that it would precede a commodity money. But in small communities, like, this was why civilizations would just kind of stop at the size of a tribe or a large family, or hundreds, in the hundreds of people, is because you had to have incredibly strong cultural ties, and you had to basically be able to have credit with each other, because, you know, you and I know each other, we'll interact again. So if I did something for you or you did something for me, it's very easy for us, even without a formal system, to just be like, oh, Lynn did me a favor, I'll pay her back. like, and at some time in the future, you know, I got a little extra deer from one of the hunters in the tribe. I'll just remember the next time I go picking for stuff or I manage to catch a rabbit that I'll give him some food back. And so credit was basically, barter was so inefficient that credit was just what it was at a small scale. And the only times that barter really showed up in history was between societies, between tribes that didn't trade with each other. And as soon as they started trading, two, three times, as soon as there was any sort of frequency between these civilizations interacting, a commodity money sprang up. Something, because barter was just so inefficient that it just didn't work from an economic point of view. That's probably one of the best, it's a really smart framing to start with, because it lends to that question of, you know, who controls the ledger, because that's the beauty of commodity money. It's a natural system, and rather than a controlled system, rather than a human system, so to speak. And what's really funny about that, or not funny, but enlightening about that, is that when you think of every characteristic of commodity money, of a commodity that becomes money, every single one of them is some physical element, some physical trait that lets it act like a spreadsheet. You know, like every single one of them is something, it's divisible and fungible. So all the points can add up or be divided. It's scarce, so you can't cheat the spreadsheet. It's independent, so again, you can't cheat the spreadsheet. Everything's about just making it work like a good spreadsheet, basically. So it's a really cool framing that Seyfedin, I feel like, touched a little bit on in the Fiat Standard, if I'm not mistaken, and then I felt like you did a really good job of fleshing it out completely. And that's one of the reasons why I've been pushing your book more for people who are new to the idea, especially economics. You do a good job on the analysis side, as opposed to like telling like the story of Satoshi or whatever. You know, it's like, you come with that engineering mindset, which I really, really find valuable. And I've always appreciated that about your work. So, not to blow too much smoke up your ass, but let's go back to the technological framing. Is you framed the fiat problem, so to speak, the concept of broken money, as something that was actually unavoidable, that was a necessity. Can you expand on what you mean by that? That this wasn't something that just was happenstance or was abused into existence. It was a necessary transition.
Sure. Yeah. The book takes a rather deterministic view of how money's evolved. That basically, if you were to rerun this over and over again, you'd have a similar kind of path every time, or at least vast majority of the time. And one, I think, way of analyzing it is to say that, a point I make in the book often is that politics can affect things locally and temporarily, whereas technology can affect things permanently and globally, which is to basically say, if you invent refrigeration, that can reach every corner of the globe forever, as long as we, you know, still have human civilization. Whereas politics, you know, can affect one area, it can then be reversed and go another direction, whereas we never really uninvent refrigeration. It's just one, like, so technology has that kind of permanent and global impact. And then the second thing we have to do is look around and say, if something happened in one place, then that's, you know, that's decisions at the time that led to that. Whereas if something happens literally everywhere, or, you know, almost everywhere, then something about the incentive structure itself has changed that makes this just either inevitable or just so easy to fall into. The path of not going that route is so narrow, and the path of getting to that is so broad that it just either happens every time or 99 times out of 100. And so by looking and saying, okay, it's a lot of people, when they talk about, say, the gold standard and leaving the gold standard, they often describe it as like a ethical shortcoming. And of course, at any given time, you can be like, okay, this politician was unethical, or this one made, you know, he made the easier decision when he could have made a harder decision. You know, there are these ethical failings that happen along the way. But when you see that this happened to all 200 countries, there's no gold standards today anywhere. The longest holdout was Switzerland, and even they gave it up. And it just shows that something more fundamentally changed that made that system just not pop up anywhere. even when currencies fail, they don't just go back to a gold standard. They go back to either a dollar standard or they just build another local fiat currency system. Gold, no matter how bad things get, gold rarely reemerges as money. Sometimes you'll see it in extreme environments like gold shavings and stuff like that, but it's such an extreme and rare environment to happen. And one of the things I emphasize in the book is that ever since the deployment of the telegraph, so it was invented in the 1830s, but it wasn't really widely deployed in the West until the 1860s, and especially over long, you know, over oceans and over continents, you know, 1860s, 1870s. It took until the early 1900s to get it all across the Pacific and everything. And so at that point, you have the whole world connected together. And that was kind of all just leading up to World War One. And that was just basically we prior to that, information and money moved at roughly the same speed. So there was still technology import. We talked about before about paper or printing press or analog encryption. These were technologies that enabled increasingly sophisticated types of banking or financial arrangements and efficiency. But the telegraph completely blew that open by saying you can transact, you know, institutions can transact across the world roughly instantly. But the physical settlements still take time to ship and verify gold. And so basically the power of the arbitrageurs, the banks and the middlemen that are centralizing and abstracting things used to be moderately important and useful, but then they immediately go to necessary, and their power is, you know, 10x'd. They have an order of magnitude more control. They basically control transactions entering or leaving their country. Everybody who's interacting on a kind of a global commercial basis has to go through credit and centralization now. And so that just became the environment for the past 150 years. And of course, you know, telecommunication systems have a massive amount of advantages for us. But one of the disadvantages is it kind of broke commodity money. You know, up until then, there were, you know, we got harder and harder money. We go from, you know, shells and cocoa all the way up to, you know, gold and silver and eventually mainly just gold. And so we got harder and harder money because speed was never really a variable. I mean, gold, you know, coins make money faster, which enhance gold and silver. But other than that, you know, money is, you know, it's just money. It's cocoa and gold have roughly the same speed. Whereas once we introduced telecommunication-based payments, speed became a variable. And so some ledgers are now way faster than other natural ledgers. And so it makes it basically empowers those human ledgers compared to the natural ones and makes it so that eventually they could just drop the natural ones and that people will basically say, okay, I'll deal with a less hard money like the dollar. It's less hard than gold, but it's faster, more convenient. So it's actually able to stick for, you know, like a century and counting, because it's, you know, it's that speed is a new variable now. And, you know, digital transactions have to come before digital settlements because the latter takes way more computation, way more bandwidth, way more sophistication in general. Bitcoin was invented nearly as early as it could have been, you know, because until they had sufficient global bandwidth, until they had decent storage, until they had even certain types of encryption were only invented like 7 years before Bitcoin. And so really this a pretty narrow window of how early it could have come. It's not like it just, you know, people were working on this since David Chaum and others, like from the 80s. It started to materialize, really kind of came together under Satoshi, obviously. And that's really the first credible digital settlement we have. And so basically we've been stuck in this 150-year gap where we have digital transactions, but not digital settlements. And that's what I argue is kind of broke money, which is that, you know, it's a local maximum. Right. So it's like it's obviously good that transactions are global and efficient, but it's bad that there's such a gap between transactions and settlements, which was not closed until Bitcoin. And even then, it's not closed until Bitcoin becomes gigantic and liquid. So, you know, Bitcoin doesn't close it just by existing. It only closes it by being used over time. And so it's this 150-year period and counting of the separation. And that's what gives us 160 different fiat currencies. They're all these little, their own little currency bubbles. And it's because centralization and abstraction have been such a key part of the system and then allows these silos to exist.
This show is brought to you by the Cold Card Hardware Wallet. My favorite setup, which I know I talk about a lot, is the Nunchuck Wallet on mobile. that just connects directly to or just talks NFC whenever I need a sign. The nunchuck does not hold my keys. It is securely on my cold card, not connected to the internet, not vulnerable to a phishing email or any malware or anything like that. If I ever need to send a transaction, I just create the transaction on my nunchuck wallet and I tap it to my cold card. I hit sign, I tap it again, and then off it goes. There is no easier interface and way of interacting that grants a higher level of security, in my opinion, than that right there. It's genuinely incredible to me that we even have this capability in the Bitcoin space. And CoinKite has just made an entire suite of fascinating security and just fun Bitcoin devices and hardware products, like the block clock. Just connect it to your node and have it show the Bitcoin price, have it show the block height, just right there on your desk in this really cool package. If you haven't checked out what they have to offer, you definitely need to. And don't, when you go over there, do not forget that I have a 9% discount code. Bitcoin Audible, all one word, gets you 9% off. And you can go through the link in the show notes or just remember the discount code, which is not hard. It's just the name of the show. You can go through the link in the show notes to go right there or just go to the store, browse around, see what you want, get yourself a solid hardware wallet, experience the tap to send with a cold card hardware wallet. It's just kind of magical. And get notified for the Q1. I'm really stoked about my Cypherpunk BlackBerry, the new model that's going to be coming out. So check that out as well. Don't forget, 9% off. The link is right in the show notes. Go check them out. Yeah. Yeah, that's that framing of understanding. There's an element too in that argument is seeing that one of the major reasons that gold doesn't exist as money is largely because it's too inefficient. You could even see fiat with all of its drawbacks as a necessary, like a net positive, in the sense that we would use gold if it wasn't worth the cost of literally every 40 or 50 year total collapse of the currency to keep the speed of the economy to grow, to still grow the base, till the technological and productive base that you can't do with physical money anymore. So it's interesting to think about it that way. It's like you said, like fiat currencies collapse all the time. They don't go back to gold. They have every incentive to from a sound money standard, but from a technological standard perspective, they still refuse to because it doesn't make sense from the concept of the networks and systems that we have to use. And inevitably, that leads to an astounding arbitrage opportunity between settlement and the systems, the payment systems. How can you have a technological point of control and power that is so great that is not abused? Like you said, political is local and temporary, and no matter what you do, somebody's going to get into position on a long enough time frame and it's going to be abused because that's humanity. That's how power works. And the technology exposes that as a vulnerability. You know, it's like a cryptography system that's just got a giant back door in it. Somebody's going to use it, you know, like, that also framed, it's funny, there's only like two or three sentences in this that just hit, and I highlighted those, and I don't think I've tweeted it out yet. I highlighted a bunch of stuff through the book of like, okay, I'm gonna go and tweet this in like 3 weeks. One of them was about the framing of the contest between countries and why, when you have fiat, because it's explicitly a credit system, you have this 160 local monopolies, and why it is that everyone has to go to fiat at the exact same time. And that it's explicitly in contest with each other that proves that a gold standard is no longer sustainable. And it's because it's a consequence of that arbitrage opportunity. But it completely reframed. I had been thinking about this kind of off to the edge. Like, I knew World War I and World War II in my mind were easier to explain, or I think more completely explained from a monetary perspective than a political perspective. But I really think that section of the book just cemented in my mind what World War I and World War II were. So
before I give my take on it, I want to hear like the argument that you laid out in the book again for the audience.
Yeah. So basically what, you know, debasing currency has been something, you know, for thousands of years. Rulers have always debased currency to smooth over problems because, you know, the other method is raising taxes, which is very unpopular, or cutting some spending elsewhere, which is often undesirable for them to do or hard to do. And so they usually just, you kind of defer and spread out the problem in an opaque way through debasement. But debasement, prior to, you know, all this abstraction, was a slow process. You actually had to get the coins back in your possession as the ruler, melt them down, reissue them like a more coins from the same amount of metal. And so you're taxing them in, you're spending them back out, and it's a slow process. And you can only debase so much so fast. Whereas in a world where everybody just holds their money in the bank often doesn't even hold the gold either. They often, they have a ledger on the central bank, but even if they don't, banks are just, you know, they can be told to do anything with a stroke of a pen.
Yeah.
So the banks, you know, the gold's either in one big honeypot or a handful of big honeypots. And with a stroke of a pen, you can be like, okay, so all the money that people are holding, either physical cash or deposits at banks, all that used to be worth this much gold. And now it's worth half as much gold, or a third as much gold, or no gold. And so you can debase infinitely overnight if you want to. And what that does is that, you know, that's an incentive structure that really empowers the nation state, usually not in a good way. Usually it like does things like allows them to fight wars in opaque financing methods. So instead of saying, okay, we want to go fight this war, we have to raise taxes to do it, which of course people can revolt against that because paying taxes is like an active thing. Like someone's telling me I have to take my income and give it to you. And when you're going through that process, that's an active step. You're like, well, wait a second, what is this money going to? And if there's enough people that ask that and get angry about that, then the war might not happen, or you know, there could be revolution, or the king has to back down. Whereas dilution's a passive thing. So if I'm just holding money and the king is just diluting the money I'm holding, not even through debase, like physical debasement, but literally because my deposits, my cash are just magically worth less than they used to be. It's just going around me. Like it's kind of bypassing my need to make an active step of like giving in my tax money. And you know, I might be aware of it. I might not even be aware of it, depending on how fast it's happening. I might be aware 2 years later that it happened and then be like, well, wait a sec, but then it's already done. We're already at war now. We've been at war. And find out it was not really paid for mostly by taxes. It was paid for through dilution that I didn't get the memo on until 2 years later. and that just, it just greatly empowers the nation state because they, instead of, you know, fighting until they deplete their gold, they can fight until they deplete their entire citizens' liquid savings. And that empowers them to do all sorts of stuff. And then the downside is that spreads like a virus, because if one side's doing that, the other side is like, well, wait a second, we got to do that too. Otherwise, we're going to lose the war. And so you generally see it's like, you know, World War I was not just some countries, you know, debasing their currencies. Every country that was involved was rapidly debasing their currency to engage in it. And that's just something we've seen over and over and over again. And, you know, even Saifedean refers to basically like the economics of World War I never really ended, in the sense that, you know, that was kind of the pivot point for this whole thing. And one of the resources I found most interesting was, I cite it in the book, William Stanley Jevons' 1875 book, Money and the Mechanism of Exchange. I was really glad I found that book because chapter 8 was a key chapter in the book. That's about that gap between transaction speeds and settlement speeds. And for a while, that chapter was not hitting very hard as much as I wanted it to. And when I found that resource, I was like, this is the resource I was missing. And basically, he's outlining in 1875 how the gold standard works. And he's talking about how hyper-efficient it's become due to technology, due to things like the paper instruments we have, and due to the telegraph, and everything is all kind of centralized communication now. Pretty much the whole world can bank through representatives in London in one gigantic centralized clearinghouse. And he's talking about how hyper-efficient this is. But then, he's like, basically things net out so much that hardly anyone actually settles in gold anymore. But then he's like, but this could be catastrophic because it's now levered 20 to 1. And so if 5% of people show up in banking hours and say, I want my gold, the system's like, well, we don't have it. So it's like, you better hope that doesn't happen. And he basically describes on one hand how efficient this is, on the other hand, how it's like a catastrophe in the making. And then, of course, it took a while, but World War One was when that catastrophe hit. So you had an era of peace, and it kind of just kept working and working and working. And then just like a snap of a finger, in 1 year, it all fell apart because of how fragile and centralized it was. And he pointed that out ahead of time. And even he was optimistic. He's like, he thought the efficiency gains were, kind of more useful than the risks. But he's like, he thought the risks were something that you could manage if you're aware of it, which ended up not being the case. The risks, eventually the system blew up in all the catastrophic ways he was concerned about. But it was such a good resource to show at the time, what is, how are people analyzing the system? And he's literally analyzing it kind of like an engineer. Like he's going into why coinage has frictions and how it's challenging and how this can make it more efficient. But then he's talking about the downsides of efficiency. And it's just such a powerful read, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. And he saw it, he could see the both paths and where it led to because he had that systems mindset. And it really was, it's a fascinating thing to think that somebody that early, like so long before it, was already seeing how, both directions could play out.
Yeah.
How and when did, actually, there's something you mentioned a little while ago. So talking about like money being devalued and the fact that you can confiscate everybody's savings, you have a personal story related to this. And did you grow up in Egypt? What was your relationship to Egypt? Because I saw you post about it a couple of different times and I cannot remember the specifics, but I remember you brought up something about the devaluation. And basically how you were related to that. Can you break that down again for me?
Sure. So yeah, my husband's from Cairo. He's from Egypt. And we go there every year and we have a property there and, like most of our family and friends are there. His family is a lot bigger than my family. So our economic center is in the US, but our social center is kind of in Egypt. My backstory was that I grew up in poverty, but it was in the US, whereas he grew pretty well off for an Egyptian. He's upper middle class in his environment, but they deal with money problems that we don't historically deal with as frequently in developed countries. We'd have to go back to the 1940s to find kind of similar types of currency issues, maybe the 70s in some cases. And Egypt, a lot of people travel, of course, but actually living in other countries, especially developing countries for a long time and knowing people who've, closely, who've grown up there and lived their whole lives there, gives you insights that are really useful that a lot of, economists will just miss if they're just kind of detached looking at things from their ivory tower. And so Egypt has been very useful because, I can cite all the statistics for how many countries hyperinflated, since the 80s, or how many countries had triple digit inflation, or how many of them have recurring double digit inflation. But the one market that I go really deep on is Egypt, because I live there part of the time. I can ask people who live through everything. I can follow in depth why currency devaluation happened, what were the steps leading up to it, how did it impact people. I know people that run a small business, or I know people that earn wages, and I'm like, how do you respond to inflation? And what do you think about inflation? And it's been a useful case study. And what I emphasized was that, I'm like surprised at how little I see this emphasized, because when people say, well, what is Bitcoin useful for? Or what is, what it's a solution in search of a problem. And it's like, clearly, that kind of mindset is very like developed market centric, where the problems are more subtle most of the time. Whereas the way I emphasize it is there are 160 different currencies in the world, and there are all these little silos. So the only way that money really gets in or out is physical ports of entry, which are obviously very limited. You bring cash or gold to an airport, you're searchable. There's limits on how much they'll let you bring through, and wire transfers, including most fintech companies and Western Union and stuff like that. These are just overlays mostly on top of wire transfers. So when a country has a lock on what its banks can do, they have pretty strong capital controls. They can affect, you know, how easy it is for people to get a dollar account, how easy it is if I send dollars to Egypt, can they actually get it in dollars, or is it going to get converted to Egyptian pounds? And, you know, a country can kind of dictate what percentage of its people can access dollars and what percentage can't, or selectively block certain transactions. And so there's basically people end up being stuck in these currency silos. It's like being in the Matrix fiat-wise. Like in a developed country, your silo is bigger and you're getting devalued at maybe 7% a year, money supply growth. Whereas if you're in a developing country, your silo is smaller and tighter and you're getting devalued at 15%, 20% a year, depends on the country. It could be more, obviously, in some cases. Most of these countries have hyperinflated or nearly hyperinflated one time, at least in a human lifetime. But either way, you're just getting rapidly diluted. And so much emphasis on inflation is about savings. So people always talk about savings being, you know, kind of inflated away. But one thing I came to appreciate more from, you know, kind of living in Egypt for a period of time, talking to people there, is how it affects people's wages and income. Because there's a natural anchoring bias, right? So if you're an employer and you pay someone, that's your anchor, and every year they're going to try to get a higher income, and you're going to try to limit how much that income grows, and it's very hard for the wage earner to try to keep up with monetary inflation. And so if the Egyptian pound is increasing in supply in 20% a year, if you're not getting a 20% raise every year, your share of that monetary network is being diluted, not just in terms of your savings. You might think you're solving your savings problem by holding dollars or buying real estate, but even just your active income is often shrinking year after year after year, especially when measured in like dollar equivalents or like global purchasing power equivalents. Like, you know, what is the cost for you to take a flight outside of Egypt or to import computers from outside of Egypt, like, you know, things that are not produced domestically, you're getting diluted at a pretty fast rate. And it's on that kind of status quo really benefits the large corporations. And it's really challenging for the workers that have to try to negotiate that higher raise every single year, or the small businesses that have to find a way, how can I aggressively increase prices so that I'm not getting diluted? And it also makes contracts very hard to do. If you have a 6-month contract or a 12-month contract or a 5-year contract, you want to lock in prices for a long time and you want to sell things. You know, obviously, the longer contracts you can do, the more it minimizes overhead. And the more frequently you have to make contracts or adjust contracts, that's more overhead, less efficiency. And when you have money supply that's either erratic or rapidly diluting, you have to have shorter, more frequent contacts. You're more likely to get messed up between your expenses and your revenue because one might be locked in at a bad rate for you. And just the effort is always on trying to increase. And people have that kind of sticky anchoring bias against it. And so the larger corporations are the ones that are more connected, more shrewd. They can do it rapid. And then it takes time for all those increases to trickle out down the cotillion ladder. And so it's really not just savings. It's also people's active income, their small business income, even like their rental property, what they charge on rents to actually have their investment pay off. Everything is much harder in that environment of rapid dilution.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting too, because it ultimately reframes all of what makes sense from a financial perspective anyway. Is the reason it doesn't affect savings as much, even though like conceptually you think about it, it's really kind of a framing of everybody has savings and then suddenly we have a fiat money system. What would it do? But if you think about it from the context of people having been in a fiat system, largely people just don't have savings. Largely people end up holding something in debt that they build equity in. That's why basically the mortgage is the middle class savings account, is home equity. Is because nobody has savings anymore. So they literally put their capital, they just go into debt into something that is going to devalue the debt at the same rate that their savings would have appreciated if they had actually had sound money. And so when in all of your like asking, and you know, you said you have kind of a a window into Egypt specifically, and like how people have dealt with it and their perspective on it. There's perspective on it. How's monetary knowledge? How well does the information flow to them about what's actually causing it? Is it still just kind of political strife of like evil business, evil, you know, employer sort of situation? Like it's just divisiveness? Or do people understand the monetary problem better having lived through it?
I would say that the monetary knowledge is not very high from what I've seen. Mm-hmm. There are certain things that become intuitive, like people know you should try to save in things that are not local cash. So people are shrewd in terms of trying to access the gray market in dollars, for example. Mm-hmm. They try to go to the real estate as a form of savings. And that's really what kind of weak money does. One is it awards those who have access to credit at the expense of those who don't or have diminished access to credit. Because anyone who can short the devaluing currency is getting ahead. And two, it makes it so that you have to save in either less liquid or more volatile assets or both, which can impair your future planning and overall kind of risk area. So you have a case where there's a lot of empty homes because people are just holding an extra home, which is a type of malinvestment. That could have been, you know, if the money was just good, they could be holding money and not kind of using materials and time and effort to build things that are just not being used efficiently. Yeah. Maybe they, you know, eventually the population increases and maybe 10 years after the house is built, finally someone uses it. But that's basically inefficiently timed real estate capital, for example.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way analogy I would use, because a lot of them are familiar with real estate, is I would say, well, imagine if like you what they'll do is they'll buy real estate in like an up and coming community. They'll analyze, you know, what's the probability this community is successful. And then over time, hopefully their real estate appreciates in price, and they kind of pay installment payments to you know, help build it out. And I'll be like, well, imagine if you have a real estate in an area and they're increasing the supply of new homes in an area by 20% a year. What's going to happen to the value of your property? It's likely going to go down, unless of course there's more than 20% of people that want to move there every year. So you're probably your house is going to get diluted. I was like, that's what's happening with your money. It's the same thing, and that clicked. So people know that they have to take action. But you know, if you go into like why did devaluations happen? Well, you know, most of them won't be able to talk about how the detailed chain of events, the IMF, they won't be able to quantify certain things. It's the same as the United States. If you ask people in the United States, what's the money supply growth rate? You know, it's not common knowledge. And of course, it matters more in a place like Egypt because that number is roughly three times higher. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that people have a quantitative sense on in general. It's more of like a qualitative directional understanding of certain things you have to do, which are not always accurate. But, you know, people understand that you have to try to get scarcer things, try to get a real estate with like a 7-year installment plan, because then you're at least kind of shorting the currency. And the tragedy of the whole thing is that the cotillion effect is just on full on display. So, for example, if you're the government or major corporations, you've got the best access to credit. You can arbitrage the difference between hard currencies and your local currency and do all sorts of things like that. If you're middle class or upper middle class, you at least have things like, you know, 5-7 year installment plans. So you're still kind of shorting the currency to buy a house. You might have access to, if you're in Cairo and Alexandria, you might have access to those dollar gray markets. And so you have that kind of access. Whereas if you're poor, you know, a lot of them don't even have bank accounts. So they're not even, you know, like a typical Egyptian might be getting devalued by 20% a year, but maybe they're earning 15% interest. So they're really getting devalued like 5% a year, plus their wages are getting devalued like we talked about before. Whereas, you know, someone who's just dealing with cash, you know, they're from the rural area. They maybe moved to the city. They're on the lower end of the economic spectrum. They don't really have a bank account. Their savings is the equivalent of like $100, which a bank doesn't care about. Like that's just the overhead costs of administrating that account are not worth it. And so they're holding literally physical yeah. Egyptian pounds as whatever little savings they have, which is getting diluted at the full 20% rate a year. plus their ongoing ability to try to increase their wages every year to keep up. And so that the further you go down, the less access of you have access to either interest or credit, and therefore you're getting really the short end of the stick. And so that's, I think, one of the biggest strategies of the whole thing. And of course, we see the same thing in the United States. It's just the whole thing is less extreme.
Aggressive by, you were saying something about that's the tragedy in the United States or something, because you can see the same thing.
Oh, yeah. The tragedy is that Cantillon effect, seeing it in action. And it is it's the case in every country, but the faster that dilution is happening, generally the bigger that gap is, and how quickly you can get devalued, obviously.
Yeah. The thing I was pointing out in relation to how you kind of articulated how it hits you where you are in kind of the hierarchy of the monetary chain is that it's actually regressive in the sense that it doesn't even just affect the poor as at the worst. It literally affects the poor disproportionately to the actual rate, because the people at the top can escape it completely. So they basically push what would have hit them equally down the ladder so that it gets worse. Like the cost is built up. Like it's literally like a bottom heavy system. And because of that, and even worse, that's one of the things that I talked about in, there's a great piece by, I think it's Hoppe. Dang it, I can't remember exactly which one this was, but it was talking specifically about employment and minimum wage and why, you know, wages are sticky. You talk about like, it's like kind of your frame of reference for, you know, what cost the cost is. But one of the interesting things was that like a natural, or I guess unnatural, but a consistent expected inflation rate literally puts all the onus of trying to sort out the difference to the people with the least amount of power, to the employee rather than the employer. Like the employee has the least power in going to their employer to negotiate, especially if they have any cash savings or whatever, and they're trying to hold that. Well, that's getting devalued at the same rate. So it puts this constant like weight of dependency on the people at the bottom, which kind of, you know, kind of cuts off the very confidence necessary to be like, okay, I can just say, listen, I'm going to quit if you don't pay me a fair wage. You know, they don't have that option, because any gap that they had, any buffer that they had to get out, is also being eaten at the exact same time. So they're more desperate in accepting less pay and not getting their compensation, because they are specifically being, all the weight of it all is being diverted to them. So it's like it's this nasty negative feedback loop for the people who are in the situation who need the way out, the escape the most.
And there's other aspects as well. Like, for example, when Peter McCormack recently went to Argentina, he pointed out that, you know, because inflation there is even faster than Egypt. Mm-hmm. And if you have a credit card, you can do things like, you know, pay in 30 days, which doesn't really matter in a developed country, but it matters a ton if like inflation was like 10% that month. And so if you're wealthy, you're buying everything on a bigger discount. Whereas if you're poor and you don't have access to those types of credit instruments, you're paying 10% more for everything. And then the same thing happens in just kind of multiple other aspects as well. That basically, you know, you're either not getting access to an interest-bearing account, and therefore you're getting diluted faster than someone who does. Or like we just talked about the wages and the small business price increases. And then, you know, there's just other factors too, that basically all everything's kind of stacked against you. Even, for example, the ability to withstand volatility is something that you can withstand better once you have more savings. Mm-hmm. So I can withstand quite a bit of volatility, and therefore I can put money into faster growing, more volatile investments like equities or Bitcoin, for example. Whereas someone who, you know, their savings is constricted to the next 6 months, they can't take on more volatile assets. And so their universe is restricted to these lower volatility degrading assets. And so just every variable along this is kind of moderate, but when you add them all together, it creates a massive difference. Is if you're in a developing country and you're the government, or you're well-connected, you're a corporate leader of some type, you're the kind of the elite class, you just have an array of tools to not only protect yourself from this, but like benefit from this. You can like short the thing that's devaluing and buy the thing that's going up. Whereas, you know,
you can use the leverage to make profit on what you know is happening, you know, like it's crazy.
Yeah. And if you're on the other side of it, you know, you're getting no interest, you're getting your paper dollars or your paper pounds are getting devalued. And all your expenses are super high. So it's just like, it's just such a massive gap between the top and the bottom.
Yeah. And what's crazy is that it literally means that the reason it distorts the free market so horribly is because the free market requires a, and this is something that Hayek talks about a lot, is the free market presumes sound money, that essentially all of the necessary incentives and balances in a free market, as soon as you don't have sound money, they're all basically broken. And in that same context, what we're seeing when it comes to, it's incredible to see the staggering amount of technological and productive innovation and stuff that happens just naturally in the market economy, when we're still in a place where the arbitrage opportunity with the way money works is so great that the wealthiest are still just the ones who play the arbitrage the best. That getting wealth isn't about being innovative and productive, even though so many people are so innovative and productive in the technological landscape that we're in, but that the greatest amount of wealth is purely in, you know, buying the spigot and selling downstream, such that it's actually a burden on the overall system, because the largest funnel for capital is literally an arbitrage. It's a technological arbitrage.
Yeah.
But it's such a fascinating, the whole thing is so crazy when you get like a concrete picture of it. And Broken Money just does, I mean, that's the name of the book, does such a good job of laying the whole thing out. Like, it's such a good big picture overview. And how and when did Bitcoin start fitting into this for you? And did you hold this? Did you have largely the same image, just kind of refined post Bitcoin, or did Bitcoin play a major part in informing the way you see the kind of macro system, so to speak?
I would say a little bit of both. I think before Bitcoin, I wasn't really sure. Like, I saw the problems, but not really the solution. And so Bitcoin is kind of the first thing I saw that this would actually, over the long arc of time, fix some of this. And two, it helps tie together the ledger theory of money, because it's kind of the most literal type of ledger money. It's basically saying, okay, instead of a human controlled ledger, here's a distributed ledger, and kind of like a commodity money, it's backed up by scarcity, right? So the distributed nature of the code keeps it scarce, and the proof of work keeps it scarce. That combination, specifically the difficulty adjustment was such a big kind of breakthrough for Satoshi compared to prior cryptocurrency attempts. Kind of like when you encounter, like whenever you encounter something new, it makes you think about it. And then you're trying to figure out, like, if your mental model was 90% of the way there and there's just something missing, and then you have a new thing that you have to analyze that kind of breaks your prior molds. You're like, this is not quite a commodity money, but it's not really credit either. And you're like, well, what is it then? And like, what gives Bitcoin value? What traits of it make it valuable? What makes it money? And that helps then go back and even reassess those other things, because now you kind of filled in that last 10% that I think is helpful. And then also it helped me realize that currency silo problem, because you realize how tight currency kind of capital controls are, because until Bitcoin, it's almost like you accept them as inevitable because that's how things are. Whereas what Bitcoin is interesting in the sense that it has infinite value density. So when you go through an airport, for example, if you memorize 12 words, if Michael Saylor could bring $1 billion worth of Bitcoin with him through an airport, right? And it's funny. Like, you're sitting in a line at an airport and you see, no cash over $10,000, and you're kind of chuckling to yourself. And you're like, how do they know that not everybody in this line has some sort of way to access some or all of their kind of, liquid value? Even things like stablecoins, they have tons of shortcomings. They're centralized and all that, but what they basically are is offshore bank accounts for the middle class. It just kind of broadens the number of people that can hold foreign centralized assets, And it gives you that infinite value density of, you know, a stablecoin broker could go through an airport, bring any number of stablecoins with them. They can only bring so much physical cash, but they can bring, you know, millions and millions of dollars of stablecoins, and they can be a broker in that country. And so what things like Bitcoin and to some extent stablecoins do is they just punch holes through all these 160 fiat currency bubbles. And so not only does Bitcoin itself compete, but then any money can compete. Like, it actually makes the dollar more competitive in that country because dollars can flow into that country faster now, which is not always a good thing, but it's a thing. It basically, that money is now competing in the marketplace in a way that Austrian economists would expect it to. Because if you have closed borders monetarily, it prevents or reduces that monetary competition. Whereas anything that kind of pierces those borders and ties them all together increases monetary competition. So it says, okay, now you have more options. You can hold Bitcoin, you can hold a gold-backed stablecoin, you can hold a dollar-backed stablecoin, you can hold a tokenized treasury. You know, kind of you get more and more into like the shitcoin space at certain points. But basically it's saying, okay, well, these are now globally competing with each other. With Bitcoin, in my opinion, being the apex predator in the sense that it's the one that's got absolute scarcity. It's the one that's decentralized the most. But basically, that's this technology just breaks this system open in a way that until literally the past 5 years, because even like the first 10 years of Bitcoin, you know, it wasn't big and liquid. Stablecoins were tiny. You know, only in the past like cycle or two has this been really big enough to actually have macro implications, not just personal implications, but macro. And given another cycle or two, and if it's all much bigger, that matters now. The fact that that infinite value density can now flow across borders changes things over time, as long as it gets big and people use it.
Yeah.
Swan Bitcoin has the full suite of Bitcoin financial services. You can instantly buy, with your bank account or wire transfer, any amount of Bitcoin up to $10 million worth. And you can easily set up what I have been doing for ages, which is an automatic purchase of Bitcoin on a weekly or monthly basis. You just pick your time frame and then automatically withdraw it to your cold storage. And still they have free withdrawals to self-custody, which I was sure would be gone by now. But you should always treat any custodian as a point of failure. And luckily, you won't have to go anywhere for all of the information and advice you need for why you should withdraw and how to do it safely, because Swan Bitcoin has all of the resources you need and will regularly remind you. About 80% or more of their customers automatically withdraw their coins. That is an amazing feat, if you ask me. Then they also have the Swan IRA if you have a traditional IRA and you want to get it allocated to Bitcoin. And there's so much more. With Swan Private, they have inheritance planning. You also have Swan business accounts, and you can even do Bitcoin as a part of your employee benefit plans. They have an advisory. They have the Swan Vault, a multi-sig service for those who want to have the benefits of holding the majority of their keys, but still also want to be able to rely on a trusted institution in the case of an emergency or a disaster. If you haven't started into Bitcoin yet, Swan is an amazing place to begin. Go to swan.com/guy. The link will be right there in the description. Again, that is swan.com/guy. And they will know that I sent you, and my beautiful face will be right there at the top of the page to greet you. I am a longtime user myself, and a huge thank you to Swan for supporting this show, and I definitely recommend you check them out.
What do you think in this cycle, which I think will just kind of generally, I don't know, I think everything goes in cycles. Everything's just kind of a waveform in some different scale to me. But in this cycle, what do you think Bitcoin's biggest challenge is going to be? And what kind of writing on the wall for the direction things are going, both positive and negative, is kind of your focus right now?
So I assume privacy is going to be one of the biggest battle. A lot of developed countries are coming along to say, okay, you can hold Bitcoin in this regulated custody environment and we can surveil it. But what governments really don't like is people self-custodying their own money. And then especially if they can do it in a fairly private way, because that threatens not only their capital controls, it also threatens their income tax model because they have trouble proving how much money someone earns. If the economy is going more and more towards peer-to-peer gig work And if that money is not as easily trackable, mm-hmm. that makes it income tax is harder to enforce and be accurate, which governments don't like. And so I think that privacy aspect is going to be the biggest thing. We've seen, for example, FinCEN kind of came out swinging with some of their recent proposed rule changes, basically putting onerous regulations on any sort of exchange or broker that deals with customers that use privacy-preserving methods, even if they're open source non-custodial methods. Yeah. So obviously going after mixtures has long been a thing that they do, but now even making it harder and less desirable to use kind of other types of privacy techniques. I think that's going to be a big thing. And people ask, I mean, so I in my book, I have a part six is all about ethics and kind of the intersection of human rights and technology. And so some of the questions I get are like, why is that in the book? And it's like, well, because that's this era, this kind of the expectations around privacy have been reset over time, largely based on technology. So prior to, you know, back in the day when people would exchange physical coins with each other or physical banknotes with each other, privacy was the default state of commerce. That other than really big things like gigantic import-export operations or, you know, big enterprises, most things were pretty small, distributed, and private. But then as we all started using bank accounts, and as, you know, governments said, okay, well, now that everybody's in these giant honeypots, we're going to surveil the whole thing. As we relied more and more on that credit and abstraction rather than physical bare asset transfer, you know, our privacy went way down, but then even our expectation of privacy went way down. People were kind of like, now, why do you want privacy? You must be up to no good. Whereas, you know, when that started, the Overton window was, wait, why do you want to surveil every single thing I do? Like, who gives you that right? Now it's like, what gives you right not to be surveilled? That's how people think now. Like, why? Like, what are you doing so shady that you don't want to be surveilled? And all it takes is like putting yourself in a different mindset. What if you're gay in Saudi Arabia? Maybe you don't want to be surveilled. Like, you know, it's like in the United States, it's like surveillance seems less onerous because, you know, it's like, how is it really going to be used against us? You know, it does, but in more subtle ways usually. But the more authoritarian you get or other places like that, it becomes an obvious problem. And so I think that privacy is going to be kind of the biggest battle in the years ahead. I don't know about this cycle, but just it's already heating up this cycle. I think it's going to be a multi-cycle mm-hmm. thing. Another aspect is just the volatility takes time. You know, one of the things I've kind of come to understand about Bitcoin is that most technologies adoption goes in one direction. So you adopt a technology, you never de-adopt it. You don't get electricity and go back to not having electricity. You don't mm-hmm. get the smartphone and then go back to a flip phone. Usually a very small percentage do. If there's like war or widespread poverty, you might. Like, there's a little bit of technological de-adoption in the 1930s, for example. But other than that, most technologies have smooth adoption curves. But adopting a entirely new technological money with its own unit of account, the challenge is that when that smooth adoption starts to happen, the price goes up, people leverage it, people buy in a mania without fully understanding what they own. And when the leverage pops and when people kind of lose, you know, 30, 50, 70% of their money, they get disillusioned and some subset of them de-adopt the technology. They say, okay, this is a scam, I'm out. And they go back to, you know, whatever money they were using. And then Bitcoin has to like build another foundation and another base to kind of, you know, keep the next cycle going. And that lengthens the total adoption time, and it shakes off a lot of people. And I think one of the unfortunate things is it kind of shakes off the most vulnerable that can't really deal with that volatility. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to say, well, I have enough savings that I can put this 10% into this very volatile asset and let it go for 8 years. Whereas, you know, if you have 6 months of savings, it's hard to be like, well, how much can I really allocate to Bitcoin because it could go up or down. So I think that that's one of the challenges is, you know, the combination of unit bias so that it's expensive per Bitcoin, even though it doesn't really matter, you know, and then two, the volatility is always going to matter until it doesn't, like until it's so adopted that it's not really a thing anymore. And then I think that privacy is just going to be one of the biggest battles. It's less about can you own Bitcoin, and it's more about can you self-custody it, and can you use ways to preserve your privacy as you do use it self-custodially.
Yeah, for sure. The privacy thing is definitely going to be a big one. Do you think there's any capacity for, you know, you mentioned And I've always thought this is that, like, from the context of a digital money, it doesn't make sense to have multiple monies. But I leave myself open to a good argument that it could happen, in the same way that the internet doesn't have one protocol, but there is basically one protocol, you know? So in that context, do you think there's, you know, you use copper and cocoa, gold and silver. Do you think privacy is a big enough of an issue that if we can't get strong privacy, that you think multiple monies could exist in the digital space and kind of the cryptocurrency space? Or do you largely think that it will be a protocol on top of Bitcoin that ends up kind of separating the fungibility or risking the fungibility of Bitcoin, where there is a community that's willing to use these privacy tools or willing to accept these privacy tools, and then there's a legitimate market that basically shuns anything that touches it?
So it's a good question. Generally, when we see multiple monies coexist for a long time, usually it's because one money is insufficient. So, for example, gold is not divisible mm-hmm. enough for everybody to use on a regular basis. It's like, you know, even a tiny gold coin is bigger than most normal daily transactions or like a, you know, a day of wages. And so that's why they use silver and sometimes even copper, like a trimetallic, you know, either bimetallic or trimetallic system. Same thing for copper and cocoa. Copper was like the big, you know, especially in that more primitive environment, that's the big money. And cocoa is like your daily money. And so Bitcoin avoids that problem because it's so divisible. So it can be, it doesn't have that divisibility limitation, which is always kind of the key reason for two monies. But privacy is a big one, I think. And one thing I cover in the book and other articles is that privacy is largely tied to liquidity. And of course, privacy expert talks to us all the time, which is to say that if everybody's using private methods, it's easier for you to use private method. Whereas if nobody's using private methods and you are, then you stand out as being like private, and therefore your privacy is not going to be as good.
Yeah.
The problem with these privacy coins, for example, is so one is they're less audible. So people trust to hold them for a long time less than they do with Bitcoin, which is like the most audible cryptocurrency. And if it's not big and people are not holding their cash balances in it, then the overall liquidity network effect of that privacy is small. And you become more reliant on those in and out borders. So even if people are exchanging value pretty privately, the points at which you say, leave that system and go to Bitcoin or leave that system and go to fiat, that's usually kind of a surveilled portal, or at least a more easily surveillable portal. And so your total anonymity set is not just people using the coins, it's how many people got in and out of that coin, which is a smaller number. And then even like privacy solutions on Bitcoin, things like coin joins, things like mixers, you know, if you're a billionaire trying to be private, it's going to be harder than if you're a thousandaire trying to be private. So liquidity is just a key feature, like a key enabler of privacy. And I think that network effects on top of Bitcoin have a better shot of building really deep and broad liquid privacy solutions. You know, for example, there's like Chalmian mints have been developed over the past couple of years. They're still generally, you know, they're rolling out in like alpha and beta versions. I kind of imagine 5 years from now, if there's a bunch of Chalmian mints and, you know, like let's say Tornado Cash, for example, right? Tornado Cash on Ethereum was this big, giant, you know, kind of privacy solution. But, you know, there's certain chokes certain throats that you can choke and make that, you can kill the liquidity in that, which they did. So it's still functioning, but the liquidity's dead. Whereas if you have like a Hydra, like if every time you kind of cut Tornado Cash, if like five more come up, and if you cut those and like 50 come up, right? If you have decentralized, if you make it easy for anyone to build privacy solutions on top of Bitcoin, and privacy becomes more normal, the overall liquidity of privacy solutions increases. And so I think that's, you know, I'm not sure. I think that's a path that makes more sense than privacy coins. You know, privacy coins are one of the handful of things that I don't really criticize too much because they're kind of up there with stable coins in the sense that they are serving a utility need for some people. You know, they're not speculating on dog tokens. You know, there are people that are saying, I want to hold stable coins because I want to have reasonably stable value for the next 6 months, and I'm willing to take on that, you know, that centralization credit risk to do it. And there are people that are, say, for whatever reason, I need extra privacy. And Bitcoin, you know, the number of errors you can make when trying to use it privately are significant. So if you're not as technical, it's just harder to use it privately. Whereas default privacy is, you know, attractive to some people. And so it is, for some people, solving a utility use case. And I would like to see some of the privacy solutions on Bitcoin become good enough that those people feel comfortable just kind of being on those higher liquid privacy layers on top of Bitcoin rather than in those other ecosystems. And I think we can get there. And I think this, we'll see over time. But I would lean towards that direction as being what I would consider to be probably the likely path.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the big thing that just makes it, one of the big things that you pointed out was that if any privacy solution that does get built on Bitcoin will essentially already have such a profound network effect and capacity to have the liquidity necessary to be a good privacy solution is a really important element. And then also is just the fact that it is a genuinely global, open, permissionless protocol, is that it will just get built at some point. You know, like there is no limit to the human capacity to innovate, and it is iterative. So anything we have today that is decent, I think, is just a suggestion or a predictor that you could say for 5 to 10 years out that there's just going to be something really good that's really easy and by default can grant a degree of privacy that we think of as impossible today. I mean, how many years was Bitcoin an impossibility? You know, I put a lot of weight on time, combining time, the right incentives, and the open ability to permissionlessly innovate as essentially the solution to all problems, in a sense. And I'm curious what, since we're kind of on that branch here, what ideas or beliefs or things, what in your concept of Bitcoin do you believe or do you find closest to the truth that you think probably most Bitcoiners disagree with you on?
Interesting. So what non-consensus opinions about Bitcoin do I have compared to other Bitcoiners? It's kind of probably a couple. I think one would be, I've long been in the camp that fees are likely to be significant if Bitcoin's successful. So I'm always kind of surprised when people are surprised by high fees. my view is kind of the opposite. I'm like, I'm shocked that fees weren't already this high, right? It's like, this particular bump is because of like frog pictures on the blockchain. But if anything, I'm like, that it's actually still shocking how little settlement and payments are done on Bitcoin and how many people want to hold it. And therefore the fees, it's kind of miraculous that they're still this low. You know, if you imagine, what is the cost to ship gold internationally? What is the cost to close a luxury real estate that people just use as store of value? They don't even live in it often, you know? And, you know, the cost for buying and then indefinitely self-custodying Bitcoin is just super low. And you get access to this global portable liquid asset. So I've generally been in the camp that fees are probably going to be significant and that, you know, when you get fee spikes, either because of a bull market or because people are kind of, you know, using it in ways we didn't intend, it's like, that's not the core problem. Like, this is the solutions have to be built with higher fees in mind, because to some extent, if Bitcoin's successful, that's likely inevitable. You know, we've offset that with things like SegWit and better batching, maybe the future covenants. You know, there are ways to mitigate fee pressure. But at the end of the day, is if we keep relatively tight block space, because you want to keep nodes, you know, easy to run, that block space is going to be, I think, valuable. And the disadvantage to that is, if you're not well off, you get pushed away from the center of the network, the most secure part of the network, and you might have to rely on other layers. And this is not a new narrative. It's something that Hal Finney wrote about in 2010, and, you know, is like kind of understood that there are scaling limitations. And so I think that, you know, whether it's covenants potentially for non-custodial solutions or just people relying on better custodial solutions, I think that these types of things are going to be a bigger part of the network, even in the long term, than people probably think. I think people probably think, everybody's going to be using like non-custodial things. They're going to send money to each other. And it's like, well, I think a lot of people are probably going to be using custodial solutions. And, you know, it just comes down to in the early part of the adoption of the network, when literally these monies are like challenging governments, if anything, that's when custody is hyper important. It's like custodying it yourself, because, you know, like the industry is still new. There's like crazy hair people in the Bahamas, like losing your coins, you know, Mt. Gox. It's just like, it's not a, you know, whereas if for example, you know, if you have, it's a more mature industry, custodians are probably reasonably safer, but there's always that threat against them. And I think one of the biggest kind of challenges within the Bitcoin community going forward, and it potentially risks, you know, kind of fork wars 2.0, is almost that class narrative that if you're wealthier, you get better access to the base layer. And if you're not, you're either in a custodial environment or you're on layers that have trade-offs. It could be a multi-sig like Liquid. You know, it could be Chalmin mints. Hopefully in the future, we have more trustless ones that can fill this need better. And I think the one way to mitigate that is to make some of those layers really good. Like if a layer can solve multiple problems at once, so it makes transactions faster, more private, and cheaper. You know, like even as someone who can access the base layer, I still want to use those layers too for other purposes, you know, for like my daily spending wallet, I'd want it to be private, fast, cheap, you know, and then I access deeper layers for, you know, savings. And so I do think that's going to probably be a narrative challenge in the future, is just how do we get as many people as possible to have money that is as trustless as possible while navigating the constraints of a blockchain, which are pretty fundamental. You know, if every email had to be stored on every computer worldwide, that'd be a greatly inefficient system. And that's basically how a gigantic blockchain would work if you just had massive blocks. And so there's clearly trade-offs that have to be made. And the question is, can layers be built that give people like, you know, 80 or 90% of the security of the base layer in ways that are, you know, private and fast and things like that, that don't really compromise their, you know, they don't really set them up for rug pulls or other problems like that. So that, as you know, that as many people as possible can enjoy the benefits of Bitcoin rather than it being, you know, just something that a small percentage of people can access.
Yeah. Yeah. And I completely see the same thing about, like, you know, fees were necessarily going to get here. And there's a part of me that's always surprised that they don't show up. It doesn't stay like that. You know, like I still think we'll probably see one sat per V byte again before, you know, this is all said and done. One of the things that's interesting to me about that, like just from a technological perspective is, conceptually, is that I see Bitcoin more, especially for the number of people who see it as a payment system and all of these things, is I've always seen its trajectory where Bitcoin acts as a monetary court, where at the end of the day, what you want is the ability to go into court and prove that you are the rightful owner. And that I suspect that custodial will largely be, because of the risk, will necessarily be a huge part of the transition. But I think, and it may literally just be a combination of covenants and BitVM. It may be something just in those two primitives are so powerful that when you combine them, there may actually be something where we can have these massive kind of custodial sort of protocols or services that actually aren't custodial, that with the custodian leaving, with them conflicting or whatever, maybe it's a $100 fee, but everybody still has all of the proof necessary to go to the Bitcoin court and say, I'm the one who owns this, give me the money. And I suspect that's the world that we find ourselves in on, you know, at a 10 to 15 year timeline, where that's the largest liquidity pool in the world. I genuinely think it will be on the Bitcoin system. And in that vein, when you kind of picture it that way, it's like, if you can get through a global, decentralized, incorruptible court for $500 in under an hour, is that not like one of the most groundbreaking technological advances that we've ever seen in the history of mankind? You know, like
exactly,
like
yeah.
even at that scale of potential cost, that's unbelievable. That's almost unimaginable from the context of history. In that vein, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, especially since I got the time wrong. I wanted to ask this just because you do such a good job of framing this all from a technological perspective, and Bitcoin isn't the only technology. Bitcoin is one piece of a hyper accelerating global landscape of technology. What else do you see right now? Is there something else that you see as comparable to Bitcoin? Is there something else that you are explicitly like, this is incredibly important to watch because of how it operates with or conflicts with Bitcoin? Like, what are the other technologies, if any, right now that you think are the most potentially impactful to essentially the story of the world in the next 50 years?
I think Nostra is another big one, or Nostra-like things. Basically mm-hmm. decentralized communication. And again, it could be one of those things where maybe only a small percentage of people use it until they're blocked and then they use it, right? So people say, well, yeah. What's the problem with Twitter? And maybe there isn't until one day there is. And you're like, whatever speech you wanted to make is the one that's being blocked. And that's when you find Nostr, right? And so having that, and it's funny because a couple of years ago, I was kind of watching that space and thinking, I don't know which technology is going to win. There's kind of the, you know, the Web 5 direction. There's like the Hypercore direction. And they have, you know, in some ways they can work together. Mm-hmm. And Nostr was actually the one that was less on my radar. But, you know, I kind of, you know, my approach with technology is like, you know, I look for inflections or critical mass. And yeah. So Nostr's
watch for momentum. Yeah.
Yeah. And Nostr is the one that just happened to hit that momentum and made sense to me. I like the trade-off of, you know, it's not a blockchain itself because it doesn't need to know the full state of the network at all times. So that eases a lot of constraints. And then two, instead of every user having to be like a power user and run their own relay and stuff, it's like some sort of middle ground between, you know, it's not as centralized as Twitter, but it does rely on these relays. But the good news is there can be multiple of them. They can be redundant. It's like a spider web of connections around the world. And that seems to strike the right balance between robustness and decentralization, but also actually being able to use the thing. And it's scaling pretty well. So whether it's Nostr or whether it's Nostr-like protocols, I think that communication is a key thing. And it was Obi of Fetty who described it as basically like information and value are the two components of commerce. You know, I'm sure someone else said that too, but basically he's the one that kind of said that to me at one point. I was like, that makes a lot of sense. And that's also why, for example, when you look at his app, there's like a chat functionality embedded into it. So yeah. It's like, you know, I feel like one of the things that a lot of wallets are missing is community around the wallet. Like, why can't you DM anybody who's using that wallet pretty easily?
Yeah.
And one of the things about Nostr that's interesting is like there's like a directory. Like if I want to send someone money, Nostr is like this directory I can look up and be like, how do I send them money? And it's just there. I can just zap them on Nostr.
Yeah.
And you know, someone asked me like, hey, can I pay you for this thing? And I'm like, yeah, just like zap me on Nostr. Like
when we were doing the stuff. It was great. It was so easy.
Yeah. And so basically having that combination of communication and value transfer is super important, because if you can transfer value but you can't communicate with others, that's very limited. If you can communicate with others but all your methods of payment are blocked, that's not good either. But that combination is extremely powerful. So I think that Nostr itself is important, but then also wallets just having more inbuilt communication to them, I think is going to be a big deal. Or just ways to... And they could be interoperable with other communication systems. Maybe they use Nostr in them, right? I mean, maybe maybe the wallet mm-hmm. provider is running a relay. There's multiple ways for that to kind of work together. But private and open communication, as well as permissionless, censorship-resistant value transfer, are just two sides of the big thing. And apart from that, the other major technology space I watch is energy. So how can energy be abundant? It's just a very different field. I watch things like small modular nuclear reactors or OTEC or deep geothermal technologies, whatever the case may be, things that can unlock the next level of energy.
Yeah.
Because I think that's going to be one of the major issues ahead as well, besides this whole money and communication issue.
Yeah. It's fascinating to think about energy too, because it's as base as you get, you know, like even potentially even lower than money in a sense.
Yeah.
Because I mean, you can't even begin to think about the creation and the sustainability of a monetary system. Like energy is it. Like that's why that chart of standard of living and prosperity and energy are basically the same chart.
Yep.
But yeah, so I like I said, I don't want to take up too much of your time. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for Broken Money. I don't even remember when I found your blog, but your newsletter and stuff, but good God, I've read so much of the stuff that you put together, and I'm a huge fan of that. You know, as someone who does have that kind of ethical perspective and gets really passionate about the kind of bullshit that I spout sometimes, I also have a massive amount of respect for the people who can stay very, very objective and kind of separate their passion from it. And I feel like you have always done a really good job of that. And that's one of the reasons why I always went back to your blog to kind of get your thoughts on it. A huge thank you there and for coming on the show. Is there anything else? Is there a topic or anything that you wanted to cover or something you wanted to share with the audience?
I think that's mainly it. I mean, people should check out Broken Money if they haven't yet, especially the audio version. I appreciate you having me on, and I appreciate you lending your voice to the project.
100%. It's my honor. You know, absolutely.
There is no second best Bitcoin narrator, so had to go with the best.
I'm clipping that one. I'm clipping it.
And even like your social media posts and you know, Bitcoin Audible as a project, the fact that you bring that content to more people, I think is great. I mean, sometimes I write like a long article and someone's like, hey, when is the Bitcoin Audible version going to be out? Because it's like, they're like, I can't sit down and actually read that whole thing. So that's super, super helpful to get it to more people. And I appreciate the work you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks for the content. All right. Lynn, appreciate it. This was long overdue. Glad to finally have you on the show. We will do it again. Hopefully it won't be too long.
Sure. Yes. Thank you.
Awesome. Take it easy.